The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. And the approach to cell phones and devices going off at IMC is to take it as mindfulness bells. Though we've asked you to turn it off first, if you can. I think it's a great, you know, someone went many years ago, I heard someone's definition of, not definition of enlightenment, but a quality of an enlightened person. And the quality of an enlightened person is that they're interruptible. And that gives you something to think about, but so something happens. And is it an interruption? Is it a distraction? Is it an obstacle? Or is there some way to incorporate it as just another opportunity to practice freedom, to find your equanimity, find your curiosity to what's going on now with me, as opposed to I'm going to write a letter to the president of the board at IMC. And so I've come to appreciate these cell phones when they go off. And you know, today it was a little bit confusing because and that just makes it more interesting. How do we hold that? And, I mean, what would it have been like if I had? Oh my God! We have a guest speaker here, a guest teacher, and this is terrible. And this is the end. And then you would have had a very different lesson. Then just, oh, okay, we're sitting some more. Anyway, so I just, this is an opportunity to offer you a little teaching around these things that I think it's wisest to inevitably happen again. There was once when a cell phone went off, and I thought, that's kind of odd, and people should turn off their cell phone, certainly, and kept going, and this is the very beginning of cell phones, and just, that's really strange. I mean, they're so mindless. They should turn it off. It took a long time to realize it was in my pocket. So it's my pleasure to introduce you to Gregory Kramer, and we're here to somehow have a dialogue, a discussion, or somehow improvise together. And Gregory Kramer has been a Buddhist teacher in America since 1980, and he's deeply steeped in the Dharma and practice. About 15, 16, 17 years ago, he got interested in applying the principles of practice of mindfulness beyond sitting silently in meditation or silent meditation retreats, and applying it directly into the world of our relationships with each other. And in dialogue, how we talk with each other, one of the core principles of our mindfulness tradition is that mindfulness is just as applicable on the cushion meditating as it is in our daily life. And part of the rich aspect of practice is finding a way to bringing it to our life as it is. What Gregory has done that with great intentionality and focus in the world of our direct relationships with each other. And in doing that has kind of somewhat courageously, but also with great dedication, explored and discovered what it's like to bring a high quality of intentionality and presence and mindfulness specifically in our relationship to each other as we talk, as we relate, and all the Dharma principles that you can imagine, I think, that he can think of. he's applied it, integrated into exploring what it's like to have these principles in our contact with another person. And he's explored it and developed this in a wonderful way in a laboratory. And step by step, he told me this morning, at first it was very tentative, he was somewhat cautious, to say it lightly, about what in the world he was doing. And he felt also during many of his years of exploration that none of his colleagues, the Dharma teachers that he knew, had any understanding whatsoever of what he was up to. and because of that, no support. So he was kind of like out on the edge, exploring something brand new. And in that laboratory of doing this on retreats, the retreats were his laboratory for this, he would have to do something called insight dialogue, where people would be in various configurations, various ways, would very intentionally sit together, be together, and practice mindfulness in relationship to other people present. So rather than your eyes closed doing for yourself, you'd sit face to face perhaps, and you'd have a dialogue while you had in a situation where you heightened mindfulness and attention, exploration of what goes on in your mind, what goes on in your heart, what goes on in the field of relationality, with a kind of a focus and concentration that sometimes only happens maybe many days into a retreat, because you get a lot of help when you're sitting with someone. The stakes are higher. And so usually it kind of gets us kind of zeroed in. And so what he's discovered and what he's developed over these last 15 years is quite wonderful. And he's sharing it out and around the world. And he spent the last couple of days staying with me. And we had some wonderful conversations about a variety of things, including what he was doing. And I thought that maybe we could have a conversation together. And I don't know what we'll talk about.
Mm. Mm. The breakfast was good.
Yeah. So your turn.
My turn. Yeah.
Back and forth.
Oh, okay, back and forth. That's a little bit too relational for me. I'm a meditator. excuse me a minute. Okay, I'll talk now. Sorry. Actually, I don't tend to be that theatrical. The human experience is theatrical enough, I think. Yeah, it's been a journey. And actually, it's been really interesting to speak to Gil, because even though we've been, you know, in parallel Dhamma universes for a while, in fact, I've taught a couple of day-longs down here, you know, quite a number of years ago. From afar, I look at this community, IMC, and what I see and hear about, right? Because I don't live here. I don't know what it's like. And what's been bubbling up and emerging here strikes me as really impressive and to the point of inspiring, actually. It's very beautiful. And I know well enough from my own experience and from looking elsewhere in the Dharma universe that this is unusual. Perhaps you know that. Perhaps you think that this is just how it is, just a cause. It's not. And so I certainly have known something is going on here, and the degree of high quality activity with what from the outside appears to be significant harmony and high standards for Dharma, practice, study, and community, quality of how you treat each other. And again, I'm not here, so I'm just looking at these results and imputing back into it, wow, this is... You know, there's something happening here in particular. And so I know that there's a relational intelligence here, and I know that the Dharma itself, the Buddha Dhamma, you know, the core teachings, I know they're at work here. For one thing, I know Gil well enough to know that about him as a human being, and yet there's so much that I don't know, both about Gil and about the community. So to come down here and teach a day long, I've done that before, and fine, thank you for the invitation. And it was a lovely day. Engaging with Gil and touching into sort of the underneath of what's happening here in some way, I now know all your personal stories. He's, yeah. Yeah, I know. Everything you've said in interview. No, actually, it was really about the, you know, sort of the intentions, the dynamics, the space that's created, and so on. You know, it's like my intuition about what must be happening is really borne out, both in its quality, but also the kind of Dhamma intelligence manifesting, not obviously not just from Gil, but that it's, you know, from each of you moving into, whether it's just coming once a week or once a month here, or engaging actively as volunteers and so on. Not the least of which, of course, is the impressive opening of a full Dana retreat center. That is a piece of history. That's a beautiful piece of Western Buddhist history that you are participating in, and it's impressive. It's really impressive. So pretty soon you'll be on videos at all these centers all over. You don't have to actually teach. You just have the videos. Is that where you're going?
Yeah, that way I don't have to relate to anyone.
It's perfect. Well, they won't relate to each other, so it's not a problem.
The, thank you.
Yeah. Is it the, such as it is, right?
Such as it is. So, so one of the things that's kind of comes to mind as you're talking and talking to you, and as you talked about our center here, is the importance of intention.
Yeah.
And you clearly had an intention of what you wanted to do, but you had more than intention. And this is what I'm interested in, is the more. You followed through on the intention.
Right.
And you followed through with energy. You followed through with, you monitor yourself as you did it and paid attention. You were curious, you were exploring as you were following through on the intention. So there was a feedback loop and learning from it.
Very much, yeah.
I get the sense that when you weren't afraid of what you were doing, you were delighted.
Yeah, tremendous amount of delight.
Joy.
Yeah.
And I don't know how calm you did this.
Good question.
But calmly you did this, but you did it with a lot, I would say, concentration.
Yes, yeah.
And I don't know how much equanimity you had doing this. But these are the seven factors of awakening.
Yeah.
And some of these clearly fed into your following through in this intention.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
without that kind of extra kind of engagement that you had, mm-hmm, that intention wouldn't have borne the fruit that you have.
Yeah, that's true.
So what can you say about your intention?
Ah, yeah, yeah. Well, often when people from the outside, the way I've seen your community from the outside, right, people see what has happened with insight dialogue and relational Dhamma, relational understanding of the teachings at the core, and they say, oh, well, you probably, you know, wanted to do this, you know, wanted to make what they see has been made. It's like somehow I thought of it and made it happen or something. It's not at all like that, actually. I've been teaching, you know, meditation for years, and happened to, during a PhD program, which I did late in life in my 40s, stumble into dialogue as an interesting practice. And not insight dialogue, just like I was exploring it, you know, sort of like, okay, I'm doing this interesting stuff in my PhD program. This was one of the directions. It wasn't directly consciously associated with the Dhamma for me at all. But one of my PhD colleagues was also studying meditation with me, and she also was interested in dialogue. And so we were exploring it together, and we both noticed that, wow, when there's this mindfulness coming in to this, it's like, wow, this is different. And we both tasted that and then pursued it together for a couple of years, mostly actually online, right? Because we were distant from each other. She was off in another part of the country. And also our other PhD friends were all over the place. So there was this, and you know, after we did our dissertation work, which was around insight dialogue primarily online, I then started teaching groups, and in Portland, Oregon, where I lived at the time. And then I started teaching retreats, Insight Dialogue retreats, in Barry Center for Buddhist Studies is where I first started. Yeah. And it's amazing that they said, sure, go ahead, even before it was a proven thing at all. Big bow to Andy Olensky and Musong. Yeah, they trusted me. Well, you know, they know that I'm deeply respectful of the Dhamma, of the teachings, and that I have studied them a lot, and that's where I was coming from, right? So they trusted that, but the rest of it, they didn't know, I didn't know. And so it wasn't that I had a vision of what this would become or the problem it would solve, right? Mm-hmm. All I was trusting was experience. Because when I entered into practice, I tasted something deeply real. You know, it was really sati. It was really samadhi. It was really mindfulness. It was really concentration. And it was enhanced. It was actually, rather than saying, I'm going to create a practice that integrates meditation into our daily lives, into our relational lives, because, hey, we need that, it was actually just the opposite. Exactly the opposite. It was like when the relationship comes into meditative experience, the meditative experience got very bright, and the development of the enlightenment factors, mindfulness and investigation, energy, joy, and so on, including concentration, actually was accelerated and amplified. So it wasn't that I was trying to integrate my practice into my life. It was like, wow, this is remarkable. Like, total surprise. So much of a surprise. I don't think I've told you this. So much of a surprise that because I'm trained traditionally, Theravada, all my teachers were monks and so on, I would not apply the word sati or mindfulness to what was happening, because that was kind of easy and obvious. I actually refused to apply the word samadhi to what totally tasted like samadhi, quacked and walked and ate and pooped like samadhi. I still wouldn't call it samadhi, because it's like, no. That just happens in here, quietly. No speaking, no looking, nothing. But then, you know, there's certain classical definitions and signs that you know well of concentration, of samadhi. You know, the Buddha defines it as there's the calm or tranquility as a component, and then there's the unification of mind. The mind is gathered, and those two qualities. So I'm investigating, and this is going on now over years, and I'm watching in the students who are doing retreats with me and seeing the calm and the gatheredness. And you can also see the samadhi by how it behaves, meaning that when it comes together with mindfulness, there's going to be insight, right? That's kind of another... It's like black box, you know, you put in these two things and this comes out. And that was happening, you know, into anatta, into anicca, into impermanence and not self and so on. I mean, deep experiences were happening. I still wasn't trusting it. But you know what totally turned me was when the piti, the joy, was coming up, which is a classical result in jhana. I said, whoa, wait a minute. This is too much. I can't ignore it anymore, right? And so then what was also happening, the practice being quite radical by Buddhist standards, meditation only happens in silence, alone. You know, I mean, you might have other people in the room, but you don't actually engage in true meditation relationally. True meditation is, by definition, internal and in silence. So this was quite a radical thing if I wasn't diminishing my definition of meditation. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's, you might even be feeling it, like, what is this guy talking about? I don't know. And so the work was getting some level of respect from meditation students and so on, and that began to filter out to the Vipassana world, the insight meditation world, and elsewhere. So people began to come to my retreats that actually had long and deep retreat practice experience. People who had experienced classical deep samadhi. So not willing to just rely on my own definition, you know, I'd call them and I'd say, hey, okay, so you just sat a retreat. And they would be like, wow, I have never gotten that concentrated that quickly. You know, and I had one guy come down after several months at the Forest Refuge. He came and sat with me and at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. And he said, I had more insights in the first 4 days of your retreat than I had 2 months at the Forest Refuge. But he continued, he said, by the end of 7 days, I was more concentrated than after a month-long of silent retreat. And so I said, okay, so I guess it's not just my bias. So strangely, really strangely, it's not like I had this, you asked about intention, right? So I didn't have this intention to create something that would heal the gap between silence, traditional meditation, and the lived life. I was just following the taste of practice. And then, of course, what's happened is just what you're saying. You know, that because you've already bridged the gap between meditation and speaking and relating, the rest of the jump into life is now recognizable. Like as we're speaking now, the quality of mindfulness and concentration, as we're being in this moment, it's like, why isn't this imbued with a quality of investigation, of meditative awareness, that might actually infuse all the other aspects of the Dhamma, the ethical practices and everything, into everything? Because when you're more sensitive, when you're awake, when you're meditating, you don't want to act with unkindness. It hurts too much. You know, things like that. So the intentions then became flowing from the experience, rather than say, I'm going to do this and I aim there. So it was like the heart intention.
So, but you said you follow the taste of the practice. It's a beautiful expression. But I kind of got interested in the word follow, because you weren't like, you know, in the back of the long line, you know, or following the, you know, clearly the map that showed where it's going.
That's true.
And you weren't in the passenger seat. You were committed.
Yeah.
You put energy and effort into, like.
Yeah.
So what's that quality that of yours? you really, like, you know, you weren't sitting in the back seat, you know, following the
masters
or whatever. Yeah, you put your life on the line. You engaged.
Yeah.
In this maybe the word is wholehearted.
Yeah, it's true.
So the word following doesn't obviously convey the wholeheartedness in which you entered this.
Yeah.
And isn't it better to just be comfortable?
Oh yeah, like why bother to do all this? part of me has to say, what are you doing? But you know, it's like when you catch the fragrance, it's like you're walking by and you know how you're walking, just walking down the sidewalk and you smell something and you turn and it's actually the honeysuckle or the lilac from around the corner and you follow and you say, oh, you stick your face in it, or at least I do, sorry. You know, it's like that. It's like the sweetness is so wonderful, and it's just manifesting. It's not being fabricated. However, yes, I mean, you know, you've been with me enough to know I'm kind of an intense guy, right? So that's part of my character, and there's a quality, a personal quality of maybe a courage or boldness, or it's actually, I think, a lot maybe more blunt than that. I just don't really care what other people think sometimes, you know. But really, there's also a deep abiding respect for the Buddha Dhamma, for the formal teachings, right? And so those have always been my anchor. So as I'm doing everything, you know, this kind of story I've been telling from the surface, underneath what's happening is I'm constantly going back to the discourses, back to the suttas, and I'm not just reading, I'm drinking them and living in the question, what does this mean? And I'm bringing them into the inside dialogue retreats. So we're contemplating with each other in meditative awareness. You know, I've gone through at this point tremendous amount of the contemplations that are the teachings in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, in insight dialogue retreats. This is so that the suttas are living teachings, mm-hmm. right? We've talked about this. I mean, the Buddha wasn't teaching philosophy, right? He was teaching a life. He was teaching the realization of this human capacity. He had no interest in satisfying academic curiosity or any such thing. It was all just, this is how it is to be human, this is suffering, and the end of suffering. That's all. So I take that as, so I guess, sada, faith, right? I don't think of myself as a faithful guy, but a sense of confidence in the Dhamma, absolutely. Absolutely, right? So I'm bringing all those teachings into the Insight Dialogue retreats, and by now I'm teaching, you know, all over the world and a whole lot, and I'm working really hard, all that kind of thing. But what's really going on, you're saying you're at, you know, what is it that's, you know, you're in the driver's seat? Well, not really. In that sense, the Dhamma is in the driver's seat. So when I would bring in, I don't know if, you know, you might be familiar with the Buddha's teaching on, you know, wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace, right? And it's sort of the foundation that takes the mind beyond conceiving. Mm-hmm. That's how he speaks about it. So I would read that, it would like run through me. I'd say, wow, what a teaching. When there's the, you know, the wisdom, the truth is realized, there's this natural letting go, the relinquishment, and the result is an abiding quality of peace with full engagement in everything that is, no cutting off. So this would touch me. This is just one example, right? So, and then I remember in Australia teaching a retreat. And because I'm always at the edge, I don't know what's coming next because I'm not in the driver's seat in that sense, right? I'm trusting emergence. I'm at a retreat. I don't quite know where to go, but practice in the room is really good. And I go back to my room and I'm immersing myself in this case in the Majjhima Nikaya, touch this teaching. I'm sitting in the hall. That's it. And I invite the meditators to contemplate with each other the wisdom as it is manifested in their lives, like to touch the actuality of it, which most people are scared to do. They don't trust their own wisdom. They don't acknowledge it. It's like, I couldn't possibly be wise. Seriously, I mean, you may feel that about yourself, like Gil could be wise. Some visiting teacher who comes in could be wise. The Buddha, well, yeah, he was wise, but that's not for me, right? So I would have to tell meditators, no, find what is wise. Don't dwell on what isn't. We all have plenty of that. I certainly do. I don't know if you do, but I do. Right? So, and then they would enter into the insight dialogue and touch the wisdom, and they would find it. Of course they would find it, because it's there, right? You know that? Right? It really is. Tremendous wisdom of kindness, wisdom of ethics that we just take for granted, but also a wisdom of understanding death or impermanence in a way that might be beyond what they thought they really, really knew. So, and it's like, okay, so truth to touch like the, you know, the like the real confidence that this is how it is, and how in their lives has that actually generated the relinquishment, the letting go. And these are things that are in throughout the Buddha's teachings. He talks about this. When you see things as they are, there's this letting go. It's just like a natural law. So I'm inviting people in to explore that natural law, that relinquishment, not go let go, not, you know, Gregory says go let go, and they try to let go. I can't let go. I don't want to let go. It's not like that. You see things clearly. You see the stress, the pain, the confusion of holding on. And when there's enough, when conditions are right, let's just leave it at that. You see clearly, and something lets go. And for all of us, that's happened. Every single one of us. You know, if we stopped for a moment now and touched that, you could touch where you've let go of something when you saw the truth. Maybe it was just a harmful relationship or some obsession that you didn't need anymore. It's just like that, but it just goes deeper and deeper. So they would touch that and peace. So wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. And by the time we were done with that afternoon in Australia, there was like, you know, a lot of benefit. Let's just leave it at that. A lot of deep benefit. So there's that thread of the Dhamma that has been the roots, that have been guiding the practice. And it's, you know, the image that comes up for me is, okay, so I'm at the edge of a cliff offering relational practice in the Theravada world, in the insight meditation world that's so individual and there hasn't been a lot of relationality. So I'm leaning over the edge of the Dhamma. It's like, you know, and I could just go down in flames, you know. But the roots on the cliff are the roots of the Dhamma, right? So because the roots are so strong, I can lean out a little further. And if I didn't have the roots, I would have tumbled down long ago.
It sounds like one of the dangers for you is that you routinize your practice, what you're offering. Uh-huh. And it becomes a technique you just offer because you've learned it.
Exactly.
Sounds like you have to never quite know what you're teaching.
Totally, totally. And actually that's, you know, Gil and I have talked about teacher training also and sort of what's involved, because part of what's going on here at the community is everybody's coming up through the your own potential for engagement. Well, you know, there's also that aspect of it that how do people come to share with others, and an insight dialogue retreat to train teachers, there has to be exactly the willingness to do that.
Oh, but that's, I mean, that doesn't make sense because you're trying to teach them something,
right,
and you're telling them to go off and do something different.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Just hand it to them and say, here,
find out for yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
They might do something different than what you're about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a balance, isn't it? That's like what is at the center, yeah, right? How do you develop the meditative qualities? How do you hold a group with love and care? You know, and the sense of the depth of internal individual practices, which is the ground, right? But if you're going to go out and teach an inside dialogue retreat, and you're going to enter into that emergence, that not knowing what's next, right, which they do, and it's always scary for them until, you know, oh no, it's almost always a little scary. That means you have to really know the Dhamma, but not with the mind, just with the intellect. You have to feel it or you can't share it, right? So it's a wonderful calling out of the authenticity of one's own learning.
See, I thought that freedom was freedom would mean that I wouldn't have to be on the edge of the unknown so much, and
oh.
I would just be known, and that I wouldn't have to relate to all these people. Isn't that what freedom is?
Totally, yeah. It's freedom is just like prison in that way. Just completely, you know, shut in, shut down, and everything's known. You know when your meals are coming, they get slipped under the door. You're a devil, you are.
So, do you have any questions you'd like to ask Gregory or myself or something? Or yes.
So, Gregory, has all of what you've been teaching, is it limited to just the Dharma? I mean, have you drawn from... because as I hear you speak, I remember taking a couple of workshops that were through Ira Progroff. He was a disciple of Carl Jung, and it was intensive dialogue, mm-hmm. journal dialogue, mm-hmm. with oneself, the community, and so forth and so on. So I was just curious if you've drawn from other areas and brought it into this.
You know, wherever I can learn, I like to learn. For example, there was a couple of years where I was really actively inspired by Quaker teachings on listening, just listening, not on religion and so on. And because they've been listening for hundreds of years in a context of a group mysticism. Right? Direct contact with God. The image of direct contact with God, unmediated contact with God as a collective practice is very inspiring. And the quality of mind that is receptive, that allows that receptivity to the divine, is to me astonishingly beautiful. And just like, you know how Tibetan Buddhism, they have these amazing, florid, exquisite ways of languaging things, you know, the way thoughts self-liberate and talk of luminosity, all this beautiful ways of talking about the mind. I felt that the Quakers had that in relation to listening in their own humbler way. But since I don't see what I'm teaching as technique, I'm not trying to draw technique. The practice is coming up out of, if any technique at all, it's straight ahead Vipassana technique. And the other, see, Vipassana is an interesting, I mean, it's an interesting construct, this Vipassana meditation. And Gil,
you mean the West?
Yeah, Gil is actually much more of a Buddhist scholar than I am. So I'm a little, I don't want to say too much because you may have a lot more to say, but Vipassana sort of is what came up out of Western students being influenced by teachers who were very focused on one discourse of the Buddha, the Satipatthana Sutta. It's a brilliant teaching, and I take that as one of the foundational teachings in my own teaching. However, when you look at the totality of what was taught by the Buddha, it's actually the path, the fourth noble truth, the path in the broadest sense. Satipatthana practice is an important slice of that, but it's a slice. So you can't make up the full image of the human body with one slice of a CT scan. You have to put all those slices together to see the shape of the heart or what's wrong with the spine. And so it's that entire tradition of practice that's drawn from the suttas and from my teachers, of course, and from Vipassana, as we're talking about it in this modern Western framework. And so, you know, like someone would come to a retreat, I would be teaching something a certain way, and they would say, you know, my experience was like this, you might think about doing this way because I think it would work better. If it was a good idea, and it felt like it was coming out of the practice and manifesting in a way that was harmonious with the Dhamma, not theatrical, not technique-y, not out to fix relationships or make better communication. If it was harmonious with wisdom, liberation, then I would try it, watch what happened, and bring it out. So in that sense, I think one of the things that I've done reasonably well is steer clear of technique-iness, even though what's emerged over all these years is quite a clear form, mm-hmm. right? But it's a form that has integrity.
I just want to say about the experience I had yesterday with you. It's in the retreat yesterday here. It was all about what you said. In one day, experiencing the real concentration, the mindfulness, the peace, this insight and wisdom and the joy in one day.
Mm.
It was amazing.
Mm.
It was so deep.
Mm.
That I am so grateful
for Gail
too, for bringing you.
Yeah, she was holding back on it. She didn't tell me yesterday.
when you were describing your first experiences of tasting this relational thing that
right.
happened,
yeah.
I had an image of this kind of eye-to-eye, face-to-face setting. And then you said, and you know, we were doctoral students, and then most of it took place online. After that, my brain kind of exploded.
good.
Online. So could you tell us some more details about how you can have that experience in pixels? Because so much happens now online in our communication and our...
Yeah. So I want to give you a little context, if I may. This was 1994. So we're talking about AOL text chat room. It was tough work. But if you pause before you hit enter, or you feel your fingers while you're typing, right, you're developing sati and samadhi. And then when you read, you know, up comes someone, sends something, and then there were only four of us in this first group. And you're reading, and you reread, and you watch the words touch. You watch it unfold. Maybe you speak, maybe you don't, right? And there were guidelines for this. There were teachings for how to do all this, right? And then, you know, if there's the urge to speak, which in this case is just through text, right? You know, you would do so mindfully, but you reflect before you hit enter, right? And so on and so forth. So, and then you're even having a chance to come to this different relationship with language, with your speaking mind, your languaging mind, right? Because the form, the channel, the online textual channel, forced us into that direction of development. Fast forward 15 plus years to now, where one can engage with via Skype or FaceTime or Google Plus or whatever, at least voice to voice, if not video to video. So you have more bandwidth, and you still have the same meditative principles. But now also there's a global community. It's small, but it is global, of people who have learned to practice this way. So the barriers usually associated with the distancing, the not face-to-face, the not presence, like we can talk about all the deficits for sure, and some people will come in and bounce off and go away. But I can tell you for sure that there are people studying deep, deep teachings like dependent origination and, you know, really deep investigation of the Eightfold Path and, you know, of liberation and all these things in this framework of practice. And our teacher training, there's teachers, you know, all over different countries. And we can only meet face-to-face once a year as a whole group. So we train as a group via Skype. Right? The teachers' council, we're all over. So we have to meet, and we have to make it real. But, because I really want to be honest with you, right? Or else it's like, forget it. You won't trust me, and I don't want to present any sense that's where it's not happening. Or shall I say, there's no question that when we come into these same people, into the same room, and bandwidth isn't an issue, except the bandwidth of attention, of awareness, and there's whatever is happening in the body and energetically, which I don't make no claims about, I don't know about that, I just notice that this experience is quite remarkably different also, right? Then the practice has a certain power and presence. But I would argue that Skype and other, you know, companies dedicated to understanding what's really happening in the communication channel could find no more sensitive instrument than a person in some people engaged in relational meditation if they want to investigate the communicative, the shape of the communicative potential of online media.
Yeah. Great. So thank you. We should stop.
Oh.
And we can go on and on. because it's time. So I want to thank you very much, Gregory, for coming. And I feel it's a great fortune for us as a community to have you come here and not only share what you've learned, but also to demonstrate your engagement in this way that you've blessed us all with. Mm. And I think it's an inspiration for all of us maybe to both trust more and trust being on that edge and see what comes as we explore the Dharma and the edge.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I want to also say thanks for having me, but also thanks to you and to all of you for doing what you're doing here. I think it's a real, it has a leadership role in the whole Buddhism in the West and certainly Vipassana communities. But, you know, the experiments you're engaging in you know, the effort and intelligence that you're collectively bringing is so valuable. So thank you for that.